Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us, wherever you're listening in Southern California or worldwide at kpecc.org or via our smartphone app. Coming up later, we'll have the very latest on the convening of the joint session of Congress just getting underway now to certify the Electoral College vote, making Joe Biden president of the United States. We'll dip in and out of that over the course of our 2 hours as events warrant, bring you updates on that. We'll also later this hour be focused on Democrats poised to take both of the U.S. Senate seats that were up in a runoff in yesterday's Georgia elections. That would effectively give Democrats a majority in the Senate with the ability of incoming Vice President Kamala Harris to cast a deciding vote if there's a 50-50 party line split. We'll have that later. But right now, we turn our attention to the crisis in COVID-19, where California is so swamped by coronavirus cases, the state has ordered hospitals with capacity to accept patients from other areas that are maxed out in intensive care. That means some Northern California hospitals might well expect to have patients sent their way from both Southern California and the Central Valley. Joining us to talk about the crisis in which we find ourselves is Huntington Hospital in Pasadena infectious disease specialist Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Dr. Schreiner, so good to have you back with us today.
Nice to be back, Larry.
Also, I have to say, I really enjoyed reading the profile of you in the Pasadena Star News. It was just a wonderful look at your life and your work in infectious disease over all these years. So very nice to read that. Let's start, first of all, with where we find ourselves. And let's begin with your hospital. What are you dealing with at Huntington?
It's a tsunami. It really is. I've never seen anything quite like it. It's just we have COVID units all over the hospital. We have ICUs all over the hospital, and we're very much capacity with our ICUs right now. We're managing. The staff continue to impress everybody. I mean, they just carry on with great spirit and incredible strength, taking the best care of their patients as possible. Most people know we have tents now set up outside the emergency room, one to accommodate triage patients and then another to accommodate patients that might be admitted or even perhaps sent home. We're trying to be creative in how we manage things. We have our auditorium is now for patients that are being discharged but need a little time to kind of make sure they're stable enough to walk out the door. And so we're doing all kinds of ways of trying to keep the census manageable. We've tried to recruit some more people, other staff to, you know, help with the nurses. We've spread them a little bit thinner than they normally are, especially in the intensive care units. I don't know how long we can sustain this. I think if we can just get through this month, then we might be able to get on the other side of it. But it is really a horrendous task right now.
So the end of the month, is that in anticipation that the after effects of Christmas gatherings will have run its course by then?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that when people get exposed, you know, they're kind of sick for a little bit for the first week. It's the second and third week that in especially high-risk individuals, but unfortunately even people who don't have any risk factors, can become gravely ill. And once they get into the hospital, and especially once they require either being put on a ventilator or at least admission to our ICUs, they stay there for a long time. So it's not like we're turning patients over quickly. And they get and so what we're afraid of is that we're certainly still dealing with some of the aftermath from Thanksgiving right now, and now we've got Christmas and New Year's on top of it. So I think by the middle of this month, it's going to be even more dramatic, but I'm hoping that we can kind of get over the top of the crest of the wave anyway by towards the end of the month, and then we'll begin to see it ease off a little bit.
Dr. Schreiner, we're hearing that perhaps to some of us, a surprising number of healthcare professionals are turning down taking the vaccine, at least right now, not being ready to use it under the emergency authorization by the FDA. Do you know what percentage of employees at Huntington eligible in the first priority group are turning it down? And if so, what's happening then with those dosages of vaccine?
We've had a pretty high acceptance of the vaccine at our facility. We did a survey before we started vaccinating, and about 80% said that they wanted to take the vaccine. We're a little short of that right now. Some of that is people want to take the vaccine, but they sort of want to, quote unquote, wait and see what other people are experiencing when they get the vaccine. And so we're going with that. That's okay as long as they eventually get vaccinated. I'm getting my second dose tomorrow. I still have only one nose. I haven't grown a new nose.
And your arm didn't fall off. That's good.
Yeah, my arm didn't fall off. It was a little sore. But these vaccines are very, very safe. They're highly effective. And I will tell you that our vaccine program at our facility, I think, has really given has been kind of a morale booster for the staff because, you know, it's not 100% protection. We're still very careful with our PPE. But it gives them at least some little bit of security that when they're in a COVID ward for 12 hours a day, that they're likely not to get infected. And so I think eventually we'll have an even higher turnout. But our facility, we've been pretty lucky. We've made a really big effort to be entirely transparent about the process and discuss the vaccine over and over again about its safety and its efficacy. And I think we're going to be in good shape.
What do you think is behind the concern of those employees not taking the vaccine? Is it the rare but serious cases of patients healthcare workers with allergies who've had anaphylaxis? Access as a reaction, or are there other concerns that have been raised?
I don't think it's the anaphylaxis thing, because I've had a lot of my colleagues and patients, you know, say, I have anaphylaxis, but I want to get the vaccine. And so we work around how we can facilitate that. So I don't think it's that as much driving it. I think it was, you know, perhaps the name Operation Warp Speed that kind of put people off. Oh, this is too fast. We don't know what's in the vaccine. It hasn't been tested, blah, 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 that kind of stuff. But the truth is this technology has been around for 30 years. It's mRNA technology is not new. We did have an mRNA vaccine for Zika that appeared to be very effective and safe. It wasn't rolled out because the Zika virus kind of disappeared for the most part. So, you know, I think it's more anxiety over it's something new and it's being injected into you. And, you know, there's sort of the social media issues we have to get over as well. But, you know, I can tell people it's a very safe vaccine. It's not going to harm you. It may well save your life. It'll certainly help society get back to a normal, hopefully some sort of normalcy. And it's our only way out of this thing.
Do you know if there are doses of the vaccine that have not been given or are not going to be given quickly, like you're getting your second dose tomorrow, but that are sitting there, the hospital awaiting what to do with them, or is everything that's on hand spoken for?
We are trying to get as many, as the Brits would say, as many jabs and as many arms as possible. So if we have some vaccine left over that has to be used, you know, when it's defrosted, you have to use it for each day, you have to use it fairly quickly. If we have some left over, you know, our infection control guys go around the hospital and go, okay, you were down the road, you want to get your vaccine today, we'll give it to you right now. So, you know, we haven't had that experience. We've only had like one or two vaccine, you know, doses that had to be wasted. But for the most part, we've been just really doing is get as many shots in people's arms as possible. And it's been pretty successful.
And this because you've got Pfizer that is in the ultra freezing temperature, right? So once you thaw that, you've got a limited time to administer it.
That's right. Yeah, most of our first folks like me got the Pfizer. We also have Moderna now as well, though, and so we're starting to vaccinate with Moderna as well. That's not quite as volatile as the Pfizer one, but it is still, you have to use it pretty quickly. So, again, it's just all about, you know, if you want to move to the front of the line, if we have extra vaccine, we're going to, you know, and you work at the hospital and you're a frontline person, you're in Tier 1A, then you're going to get it right away. And I think that's what the health departments want to do. It has to be organized. You don't want to stampede. But I think that we're really trying to make sure we don't waste any vaccine. It's a very precious thing.
Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist at Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, with us on Air Talk. We're taking your questions at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. You can also tweet at Air Talk, post on our Facebook page, or post on the Air Talk page at kpcc.org. We have a family member of one of our Air Talk team who was hospitalized, a 94-year-old with a kidney infection. This was in Hawaii, and the patient was vaccinated because, you know, they're putting the patient in a hospital, high-risk category. Is that going on at Huntington, where some of the patients who are particularly high-risk coming in for things other than COVID are being vaccinated?
That patient was vaccinated for COVID?
Yes. Yeah. They went in for the patient went in for a kidney problem, but then was given a COVID vaccine.
So that's we're not in that process yet. The general public is going to be sort of under the purview of the public health departments and some of the local pharmacies, national pharmacies, CVS and Walgreens. So we're not routinely doing that. That might have been some unusual circumstances. Every state is different. I assume this was in Hawaii.
Yeah, Hawaii, yeah.
Yeah, so every state is different in how they want to do it and how they form their tier system. You know, states that aren't as populous as California have maybe a little bit more flexibility in terms of who's going to get it first, but we need to get the healthcare workers first. You know, that being said, I think it's going to be pretty quick, hopefully, in the next few weeks that we begin to roll it out into the elderly, greater than 75, people with comorbidities, teachers, first essential workers, and, you know, hopefully with the amount of vaccine increasing and with a little more organized system, we can get this happening pretty quickly.
Let me just quickly update on what's happening in this joint session of Congress as now senators are filing out of the House chambers because there was a Republican objection to Arizona's electoral votes that was made. This now requires that the senators and the House members go back to their respective houses and have a vote on what happened with Arizona's tally. So there's going to be a debate over the objection to Arizona's electoral votes, and that'll be dealt with separately in the Senate and the House. We'll keep you updated on the very latest with the joint session, which is typically a kind of a formality. It's more ceremonial than substantive, but of course this time around we've got about 12 Republican senators as well as some Republicans in the House of Representatives who want to have an investigation into allegations of fraud in the presidential election and want to withhold the certification of the Electoral College vote, which made Joe Biden the president-elect of the United States. 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. Dr. Schreiner, Kevin in Glendale writes on our Facebook page, why aren't we seeing the mobilization of Navy hospital ships, convention center space like we saw last spring? Seems like the extra care facilities could really be used now given the current caseloads. One thing I saw about that, was it the Mercy, the ship that came to the port of San Pedro months ago? It's apparently having work done on it. They're fixing the helicopter landing pad, so it's out of commission. But can you speak to the issue, like Huntington had part of the Pasadena Convention Center ready to go back in April?
Well, the issue isn't space. I mean, we actually have space. Huntington's a huge hospital. You know, we still have a lot, many parts of the old hospital with beds and so forth. It's all about staffing. And that's, you know, we'd be happy to open up the convention center, but we don't have nurses to staff it. So you can't have patients over there just parked in there by themselves. And that's the big issue. It's not the actual physicality of it. It's the people part of things, the personnel. And, you know, during the first sort of big surges back east and when they were kind of sporadic in different parts of the country, nurses could fly in from other places that weren't having surges and provide extra support. But now we can't do that because the entire country is in the middle of a surge. And so that's the big problem. In California, we're kind of getting the worst one we've ever had right now. So it's not a really space issue. It's a personnel problem.
So what then made this possible months ago when these extra spaces were set up? Was there just hope that you'd be able to move personnel around from region to region? And now we're facing a statewide crisis. You can't do that. What's different now than what had been planned months ago with those extra facilities?
It's just the amount of disease. We just have a ton of disease. I mean, there's some estimates, you know, 1 in 80, 1 in 50 people in L.A. County are infected with SARS-CoV-2. So it's just the amount of disease is so overwhelming, the volume. There's just not enough healthcare personnel to take care of these people. And, you know, they're exhausted. They've been doing this for 10 months. Many healthcare people themselves have become infected. Some sadly have died. So it's just a Herculean task. And you have to be careful. The sooner you spread the personnel to the patient population, the more likely it is that patients aren't going to get the kind of care that they really need to get. So that there's danger in spreading people too thin. But at this point, we don't even have that. We would not be able to staff those kind of extra facilities. So there's certainly the room there. There's even the beds. It's just there's not nurses and PAs and those kind of people to take care of them.
What are the implications for people who are in serious car accidents, have symptoms of a heart attack or stroke, and an ambulance is sent to transport them to a hospital? What's happening now to those patients?
Well, right now we're a trauma center and we're trying to manage those people. We have ICUs still for non-COVID patients and we're just trying to do this in parallel. But that is a really significant factor. The collateral damage for non-COVID related diseases and mortality is going to be something we're going to have to look at, you know, when we look back on this and figure out how we can have systems that can respond better when we're in a pandemic and still maintain good care for the rest of the people. And that's a big concern. You know, we don't want people to go to the emergency room for small things, you know, that don't require urgent care, but we also don't want people to stay at home with a heart attack or a stroke or some really calamitous event. We need you to come to the hospital. We will take care of you as best we can. It's much more challenging when we've got this other disease on top of us.
We'll continue with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital. Your questions for Dr. Schreiner at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Post on our Facebook page or tweet at AirTalk. We'll pass your questions on to Dr. Schreiner. We're also keeping an eye on what's happening in the House and the Senate as what is typically a pro forma certification of the Electoral College vote for president is going to be apparently a quite drawn-out affair today. Already an objection to Arizona's electoral vote that has led the joint session to break up, members of the House and Senate to go to their respective houses to debate that and ultimately vote. You're listening to Air Talk on KPECC. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Vice President Mike Pence says he will not intervene in Congress's electoral count to change the outcome of the election and Joe Biden's win. He's rejected President Trump's pleas that the vice president reverse the results of the election. We'll keep you updated on the very latest right here on Air Talk over the course of these 2 hours. We'll also bring you the latest on the Georgia senatorial races, where the two runoff seats yesterday, strongly trending Democratic. The Associated Press has already called one of the races, with the Reverend Raphael Warnock being declared the winner there. The other race still too close to call, according to news organizations, but nonetheless, there is a fairly significant lead for John Ossoff of the Democrat in that second seat. We'll have the very latest on that right now. Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital in Pasadena with us to talk about COVID-19 at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. What are your thoughts about the mental health consequences of what we're going through? People with high anxiety, particularly with the amount of coronavirus that's out there in the world right now, and people still needing to go out and do grocery shopping and the like. Not to mention fears about, you know, if something happens to them, you know, not being able to be admitted to the hospital for treatment because of the surge of COVID patients. Your thoughts on where that leaves us mentally?
I do think that there's going to be some real serious sort of PTSD and mental health consequences of this. I think we're seeing that already. There's been an uptick in alcohol abuse and some substance abuse issues. I think depression is probably still a big issue. I do think the vaccines maybe have given the entire world a little sense of hope, and it should, because it is going to be our way out of this, and I do think we will achieve that. I think that I'm also impressed, though, with the fortitude of people. They just kind of power on. You don't have a choice. We've got to put one foot in front of the other. We can get out of this. We have the capabilities of doing it. We are doing it. And I think it's just using common sense. Just try to, you know, hang in there for another few weeks. Get vaccinated if you can when it's available to you. And continue to be careful. And then, you know, hopefully by the summer or the spring, there really will be some light on the horizon. But it has taken a terrible toll, Larry. And I think for families who've lost somebody to COVID or who've had a lot of serious consequences because of this, financial or otherwise, you know, it's going to have ramifications for months, if not years.
I wanted to talk about kids under 12 who are going to be part of a clinical trial of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. A call has gone out for kids here in Southern California to participate. They're looking to have kids receive the shot by the summer, according to the Orange County chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Vaccines, of course, are not approved by the FDA for use in those under 12. Your thoughts, about parents considering whether they want to have their kids participate in the clinical trial?
Well, I think in general, children do very well with vaccines. The issue is not so much the side effects of vaccines in kids. It's whether they're going to have the enough response that's lasting, because their immune systems are immature and not well developed, and sometimes they don't respond to vaccines the same way that adults do. It doesn't usually have long-term side effects in terms of a deleterious effect, and I know that there's a lot of people that would disagree with that. There's concern about, potential things that could happen with vaccines, but they've never been proven. And I think that the science really supports the safety of vaccines. And this vaccine is not a live vaccine. It's an mRNA vaccine. It really doesn't do anything to your own body other than protect you against the virus. We know that although kids tend to be less symptomatic with disease, that some children do develop very severe disease. Unfortunately, some children die from COVID-19. So I think that they need to be vaccinated. They also are a source of spread. I think you have to be realistic. If that's a population that can continue to keep the pandemic going, then they need to be vaccinated. So I would, if I were a parent, I would think seriously about, having my child vaccinated.
We've seen the UK variant of the coronavirus spring up in San Diego County in numerous locations. Big Bear, there's a report of a case with that variant there. What's your sense of its prevalence and the degree to which it provides a new challenge in treatment?
Well, the first part, I'll answer the first part of your, or last part of your question first. The treatment issue, we don't really have good treatment for COVID. That's really why the vaccine is so very important. Unfortunately, the monoclonal antibodies are also proving not to be very helpful. They're for very early disease, they might help keep people out of the hospital, but whether they really help prevent the disease, and certainly in their use in people who are well-established COVID, is very poor. So the only way out is vaccination. This B.1.1.7 variant does appear to be covered by this vaccine, so I'm not too worried about that. There's a South African variant that's being looked at that might be a little bit more of concern. This is a natural thing for these viruses to do. They evolve through the pandemic. They might pose some challenges for the vaccine, but again, that's the beauty of these mRNA vaccines. You can kind of dial them up and dial them down to accommodate any kinds of significant changes in the virus that might require a change in the vaccine.
One of the challenges we're seeing is illuminated in a tweet that we received from A. Murphy. How can the thousands of people working as independent contractors on the front line get vaccinated? We're not employees, and being denied the vaccine because we're not employees of the facility that we work at. Concurrently with what A. Murphy is raising, we've also had a number of vaccination centers here in Southern California, according to LA Times reporting, where people have just been able to show up without showing any work identification that they're employed by a healthcare facility and get vaccinated, as though, they set up these vaccination centers with no plan whatsoever to identify that the people are actually in the first tier prioritized for vaccination. So how do we end up in a place where people who are on the front lines aren't getting vaccinated because they're independent contractors, and then people who just show up at a vaccination place getting in line or getting vaccinated?
Well, I think as we begin to really mobilize the vaccine, I think this will all become sort of irrelevant. The bottom line is, if you are a person that has frontline exposure right now to patients with COVID, whether you're an independent person or not, in the next few weeks, the public health department in the state will be setting up access to vaccines. And there are LA counties doing that right now. For example, you're a hospice worker that works for a private agency. You can enroll on the LA County site and get an appointment and get vaccinated. So those kind of things are happening right now. We like to do it in an organized fashion. We saw what was happening in Florida, where there were, people lined up for hours and then they wouldn't get vaccinated. That's not what we want to do. But the bottom line is that the more shot to get into arms, and the more people are protected, the better it is for you, for that individual, and for society. And I think in the next few weeks, you're going to see more organization, the ability to roll these things out faster. Walgreens and CVS have signed on as potential sites for vaccination. Vons is being used, apparently, for vaccinations in some. The health departments are coordinating it. So I think that for an independent person, go on the LA County website, see if you can enroll and get yourself vaccinated, and encourage your friends to do that that are doing health care right now. But then the next tier, the 75 and older, will be happening pretty quickly. And I think they're going to move fairly quickly through the next few tiers, teachers, and then the general public. So, again, by the spring, maybe the early summer, everybody should have an opportunity to get vaccinated.
The Los Angeles Times also reporting more than 2,200 people working at LA County hospitals tested positive for the virus during the month of December. That's about a third of all the hospital staff infections reported during the totality of the pandemic. So we've seen a tremendous increase in COVID-19 positives in hospital settings. The presumption is this isn't happening at the hospital because people have the personal protective equipment, but that they're getting this at home, likely from family members. Are hotels and whatnot still available for healthcare workers so that they can cut down on the risk of exposure at their home?
Yeah, I think there's still, some of it depends on the communities. Occidental College was very nice to reach out to our staff to house them if they needed to. Nobody's been able, had required that, but they certainly made the offer. I think some of the local hotels are providing that sort of service. So there are ways, if you need to not be going home to your family and infect them, you know, then there are ways that you can find a place to be. They're a little bit harder to come by right now just because everything is kind of, you know, just focusing on trying to get through this surge. But that is a way of protecting your family a little bit. And you're absolutely right, Larry, that most of the infections in healthcare workers are happening at home, not at the facilities, as long as they're observing good PPE.
All right. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Anthony in West Hollywood says, are there any activities we should limit ourselves from doing between the first and the second doses of the vaccine?
Well, I mean, we should limit our activities that could potentially expose you to the virus. You don't want to, this is not take your, you know, rip your mask off and go roll around in COVID. The vaccines are protective, but you still can get the disease. Five people in the Pfizer, four in the Moderna got the disease during the trials that were vaccinated. So it can happen. You may have milder disease. Now, the other really important piece to remember is that we don't quite know whether you can still transmit the disease and carry it, the virus. So you have to be very careful of being around people that have not yet been vaccinated or who are very high risk for complications with COVID. And so, you know, keeping, again, limiting the numbers of people that you encounter. This is not a free ticket to go out to a restaurant and take your mask off and not be careful. We need to be careful for the next several months as we increase the number of people vaccinated. In terms of exercise and so forth, you know, it's probably not the best thing to go out and do a big workout the next day after you've just been vaccinated just because you're going to be sore from that, and then it's hard to know, was that because you were vaccinated or because of your workout? So some of this is common sense.
Garrett in Pasadena asks, the state of California and Los Angeles County have been some of the most locked down areas in the country, but we're also rapidly spreading the coronavirus. Those two facts shouldn't align. Why is this happening, Garrett asks?
Well, because people aren't observing the lockdown. There was some article, I think it was in the LA Times, that talked about some New Year's Eve parties of thousands of people that were sort of secret New Year's Eve parties. That's a really scary prospect. That just perpetuates the disease. And the other piece of this is just there's so much disease right now that it's everywhere. So going to the grocery store was always a little bit perilous. It's particularly perilous right now because there's a very strong likelihood that there are people in that grocery store that have the virus. So, you know, the lockdown is, if this hasn't, and, you know, it's been a rather porous lockdown. In other words, it's not been as strict as it could have been. Yeah, but that has to be balanced against all the economic and psychosocial factors of really trying to super control people's behavior. So it doesn't surprise me that we're continuing to have problems with it. But I think a lot of it is just people were not observing the recommendations that we made. The travel thing is a good example of that.
Well, and we've had, you know, a lot of people who, you know, will go out of state or out of the country for the holidays, come back here. I think we have much more of that sort of travel just because of the nature of our population here in Southern California. Also, we have a very high household size density here. Multi-generational families. families are very common here in Southern California, high density, and we know that that is a risk factor. All it takes is one person bringing it in. If you're looking at parts of the country where there are fewer people living in a household, it would seem that that in some way limits the potential for spread. Dr. Schreiner?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Larry. I think that, you know, the density of L.A., I think it didn't affect us during the March thing because there just wasn't that much disease circulating. And, you know, L.A. is a little bit sprawled out, but we also know we have highly multi-generational homes in certain parts of the county where there's lots and lots of people living in small spaces. They can't isolate if somebody becomes infected. And that's where we're seeing, you know, a huge amount of spread. So there's only so much people can control, even if they're trying to be very, very observant about social distancing and not having large gatherings. It's just they just live in a large gathering environment. So that is not really much you can do about that. It's just going to be a perpetual source of infection. And that's why getting those populations vaccinated is also super important. And I'm very concerned about our lower socioeconomic and people of color populations too. They really need to have access to the vaccines and get vaccinated. It's very safe, and it will be very, very helpful for their communities.
We're talking with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. Jean writes on the page, I'm a visiting nurse. Got my first round of the vaccine last week at one of the county sites the doctor referenced. I was very impressed with their rollout. The only side effect I experienced was a very sore arm for 2 to 3 days. I have daily exposure to COVID-positive patients, and I'm trying my best to stay safe and looking forward to getting my second dose soon. I don't go anywhere but work. I'm fortunate enough to be able to afford to do all of my shopping online for groceries and household items, but I realize not everyone can do so. I don't have a washer and dryer at home, so I'm paying for fluff and fold to avoid spending time in laundromats. It's adding up, but I'm grateful I'm able to do it. I wish more people were taking this seriously. Jean says, I really feel like I'm getting PTSD from all of the death and despair. Jean, first of all, thank you for all the sacrifices you're making professionally and personally on behalf of the patients that you're treating. And I think even for those who aren't face-to-face with what you're dealing with every day at the hospital where you work, can imagine not the full extent, but some sense of the kind of stress that you've got to be under. And Dr. Schreiner, it's just I can't imagine working these long shifts day after day after day in this kind of life and death pressure. Because I thought the worst thing we'd be dealing with locally would be a massive earthquake, which might take a few weeks for everybody to be treated and to deal with all the injuries that could result. We're dealing with something here that, you know, is going to be with us probably close to a year. And I can't imagine how difficult this is for hospital staff to deal with over this length of time.
Well, it's a real challenge, and kudos to Jean for what she's doing and her sensibility about things. And I would encourage her to encourage her colleagues to get vaccinated. It's just a real challenge. The frontline people, the nurses, the respiratory therapists, the EVS workers, they are the true heroes of this, Larry. They just plow on. You know, the doctors are certainly doing their part as well, but these are the folks that are with those patients for hours and hours and hours. I can't really sing their praises enough. I also would, you know, really like to commend the public health department. They have been the subject of a great deal of criticism, most of it not really warranted, and even, you know, threats and so forth. And this is a Herculean effort. This is the 100-year pandemic. As you pointed out, this is not an earthquake or a mass casualty event. This is a mass casualty event that doesn't end. It just goes on and on and on and gets worse and worse and worse. And so it's required incredible commitment from the part of the healthcare personnel, the public health departments, science and industry. I applaud the pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer and Moderna and Johnson & Johnson and all the others for rapidly getting out vaccines that are proving to be very effective and will be our answer to this problem. But it is an ongoing challenge and, unfortunately, nightmare right about now.
Dr. Schreiner, as always, we appreciate your time so much and look forward to talking with you again. And, of course, look forward to the day when we won't have to talk with you so frequently because we're on the other side of this. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Larry. Thank you.
Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. Coming up, we're going to drop in on the Senate floor where there's debate taking place over Arizona and the acceptance of its electoral votes. We'll be back in 90 seconds.